We're so pleased to be able to host this event in our city, and I hope that this will be a conversation. So please, I'm very open to you saying opinion. I know we have some teachers and directors in the room who actually run programs in San Francisco. And San Francisco is a unique county in that we have a universal preschool initiative. It's called Preschool for All, as most places have across the nation. And it's actually funded by a local proposition. It's going to sunset in 2 years, and the voters will vote again whether they want to continue it. And it is a preschool program that has free and reduced costs for the four-year-olds in the city. But we actually, as you know, we touch many children. You don't have classrooms in our system with just four-year-olds. There's three-year-olds in there as well, and two-year-olds and zero. So we have a big say. We want to be ready for school, and we want to be ready for life. And I think that is a big difference that we bring to our assumptions that we make about what a universal preschool system should do. So this is kind of an interesting slide for you. It's kind of, this is our city. We serve, at this point in time, 3,200 children. If you think on scale, we're 8 years into our initiative, there are approximately 4,800 kindergartners in our public schools. So when we look at the numbers, 83% of all kindergartners in our public school system have been to preschool. And that includes all the populations combined at 80% all the way up to Asian populations, which actually go to preschool at 89%. And so this is not a surprise. It's our city. There are 42.2% of our children at kindergarten speak more than one language in their home. It's a huge shift in the demographics as we see in San Francisco, and I'm sure across the nation. And of that, 65% speak another language than English in their home. And so if you can imagine the learners that are in preschool, we have a pretty diverse city. So this is a little bit deeper as we look at who are the dual language speakers and English learners in our preschools in here in the city. Spanish, 39%. But if you look at the combined Asian languages being spoken by children and families, it is higher than that. And I think we can add that. It's like 45%. And so if you can imagine in your classrooms, that's what they look like. And 16% of the children of this group come from linguistically isolated households. And those are our immigrant families where English is not spoken. So this is kind of a snapshot of our preschool for all. We have about 240 preschool classrooms that participate in the Universal Preschool Initiative. And in this grid, you can imagine in every preschool classroom, except the three on the top left corner, have Asian children in them. And there's even a possibility that those on the right-hand corner have Asian children in them. And I'm going to tell you, the yellow program is our one Spanish immersion preschool classroom. And the two pink ones are our two bilingual Spanish classrooms. And even they might have an Asian child in them. So if you can imagine, in the whole scope of the world, in San Francisco, there are some highlights as we look at this map of preschools. The blue preschools are preschools where home language is spoken and English, and of which there are some dedicated or intentional DLL supports in some shape or fashion. In the green, that's where Cantonese is spoken as a heritage language and as an enrichment. And it's one program, and it serves a mixed socioeconomic group, and where the goal is not for children to be bilingual, but for there to be a cultural and linguistic appreciation of the language. And then if you look at the red, those are our Mandarin immersion preschools. And there's something very interesting about that. Because if you look at the prior slide, what is the dominant language of the children?
Cantonese.
Cantonese. It's Cantonese, right? Mm-hmm. So imagine, why do you think we have Mandarin immersion preschools? It's hard one, huh? Well, Mandarin is the language of the future of China. And guess who goes to those preschools? Those preschools, it actually refers to two preschools, Presidio Knowles and Little Footprints. They are a private preschools. They serve our middle and upper income children, and their parents pay for the opportunity for their children to be bilingual and biliterate in Mandarin. And so it brings to light there are class issues involved in our the way that we look at dual language learning and being bilingual and biliterate in San Francisco, right? Does it make sense? If you have, this is what we see with families across the board. Families with more social capital, I mean, they have money, have more resources, and they use those resources to put their children in Chinese language schools to have that goal of an education for their children. But we don't have that necessarily guaranteed for those who don't have resources. Now, I put this slide up here because it's not new research. It's actually research from Lily Wong Fillmore. That was the no-cost study. Because we want to know what happens to language when children are exposed to preschool. Well, the bottom line is exposure to preschool, because our children are increasing. 87% are in preschool. Well, we know that exposure to preschool increases the risk of language loss. The earlier you start preschool, right, the first language, is particularly if your home language is another language, it's not the dominant language. It's not seeded until you're 8 years old, or it takes a long time for that first language to seed. The early exposure to preschool generally has a negative effect in language loss. Even if you look at bilingual programs, you'll see there's a 47% negative change in home language. And so there's more use of English, which makes sense, right? Children are exposed, they're gonna come in home, and home language patterns are gonna shift. But that increasingly tells us something that's happening in the family dynamic, and also about children's language gains and language loss. And language loss is a key issue for Asian immigrant children, Asian children as a whole. So we know that the research is really clear, and so when we started our Universal Preschool Initiative, San Francisco made a choice in that we were going to value diversity in ethnicity, culture, and language. We have a school system that also values multiple language pathways. And so we actually have immersion and bilingual elementary schools, but we had none connected to a preschool. So a preschool could exist on the same campus of a Cantonese immersion program, and the preschool would be English only. And so there is very little articulation between that. And so this is where we started. But we know bilingual children develop higher levels of mental flexibility, cognitive abilities, compared to monolingual children, right? I mean, the research has been really clear. The research that is coming down from Linda Espinosa, Catherine Snow, these things are not, no longer debatable. So we look at this, and for us, we've taken an equity approach to our universal preschool program. And that means we don't think everything needs to be equal, but we need to look at equity. And when you look at that picture, which one do you think, on the right or the left, is equity? What do you think?
Equity.
Equity. And what do you say? Why do you say the right?
Equality chances and giving the resources differently
but for the result is what we're getting the result needed.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
On one side, I mean, I guess the idea is not to give everyone the same amount of resources or equal amount of resources. It's to meet people where they are so that they can be on pretty much the same plane or have the same foundation.
That's right. Like we that. Acknowledge that we have privilege. Privilege exists in the fabric of our society. And some children have less access to opportunity. And we're reframing the discussion away from the achievement gap to really looking at access to opportunity. But the question comes to us, how do we deliver on the promise of a quality education to our immigrant dual language learning child? Can you go back, Sandy, one more time? It's okay.
Yes.
If you imagine, if we take into account, this is an equity map. If you take into account what happens when a child loses their language, what do you think that picture is going to look like? It's a child without part of their body. And so in Preschool for All, we've taken the stance that language loss should not be on our watch, if we can help it. And so I'm going to share with you some of the things that we've done at a system level and how we think about it. Some of our starts and stops. It has not been an easy road for us to really reframe, because the early childhood system is not created for a dual language learner. So I want you to look at the first box. United States early childhoods, becoming blank, but not necessarily in blank in the 21st century. There are two words I'm going to give you, and I want you to think, where do they belong? The two words are bilingual, and the other is biliterate. If you think about the Asian language, is the goal becoming biliterate but not necessarily bilingual, or bilingual but not necessarily biliterate for Asian children? Bilingual first. And in almost all of our programs except for one or two, biliteracy is not a goal. But I think what Yifan will find that in many other countries, in China, in Europe, the expectation of our children is that they read and write in two languages and sometimes three. But because I believe the Asian language is not an alphabetic language, it's a graphic language, we don't yet know what the value is for our children in being able to write and read in Chinese, in any language, Asian language. There are very little resources. So what does it take and what are we learning? I mean, we've had a lot of research and we've tried a lot of things that are in the pot. You know, we know that there are core beliefs to support DLL that don't exist. Core beliefs and myths about language learning, that you have to sacrifice one to get the other, or people have been taught that there's some delays that will happen if they learn this language, or you need to immerse your child in order to learn this language. But the truth is that they can learn both simultaneously and sequentially. I mean, ongoing assessment of L1 and L2. You know, we say there's no assessment for Chinese children, is there, Jerry, mm-hmm. on language? And Jerry's going to talk more about that. There is none in this country assessing L1 for Chinese children. We use instruments that are translated from English to Chinese, and that doesn't make sense. We have to use differentiated tools and supports for teachers and coaches. One of the struggles that we have is we can't find academically bilingual coaches or academically bilingual and biliterate teachers, because we have a history of language loss in our country, and it's something that we look at. We don't have resources, so we had to add to the pot resources for classrooms using a DLL lens. You know, if you look at the Eckers tool, right? Okay, you've got those books and you have to have the language. Well, it doesn't tell you about the quality or the caliber of the books that are in the L1 lens. So as a city, we put resources into purchasing books, and we have to go to Hong Kong or Taiwan to buy them. and we had very difficult time finding American Chinese culturally appropriate books. So intentional language plans, they barely existed when we started the initiative, and family engagement, which is the core, because in the context of learning language, family engagement is huge. The things we do know and what we've learned is that parents and teachers can play a really vital role during this time of life in early literacy development. And we know this in our field, in our research. And so we know that emergent literacy strategies, instructional strategies, can be effective in L1 and L2. And so remember when we used to, when you think of English, and we learned English by, I learned English in Catholic school by writing A like 10 times. And when you learn Chinese, in Chinese school, you learn to write the lines, and you sat there and you wrote, learned. Well, we're learning, and there's research that has come out in 2006 about the use of emergent literacy, which are more Western, in the acquisition of language in either L1 and L2. And so what we're seeing in our programs is that we are looking very closely at instruction. This is a project on dim sum of children, and they're actually having instruction in both English and Chinese, and they're written forms as well. They're writing stories, they're doing very much by God's skin work and constructing their own learning. Focus on emergent literacy skills by creating literacy-rich environments and nurturing relationships need to include functional print in both language, right? And so what we were seeing in our preschools is in one language but not the other, with values over expressive language versus functional, and not knowing how to code them. So again, we see that. From the perspective of the constructive learning theory, the process of effective literacy learning is that children engage in meaningful activities related to language. So children are going to a bakery, they're going to write in Chinese, they're going to talk in Chinese, and they're going to write and talk in English, depending on their primary teacher of instruction on that day. And so in everything that we do, we're using emergent literacy practices, but using it in both languages. We want children to connect their own previous experiences to the stories and pictures in written language in the L1. And this was not happening as frequently as we would have liked across the board. And so this is something that our teachers are learning to do. And this is actually Jerry's program. And they did a shoe project, right? And so the children who go out into the community, they're writing about it, they're playing, they're doing symbolic play in all areas of learning, integrated learning, in the home language and in English. This is yours, do this. They're making sense of written language and use it for different authentic purposes in both languages. And so again, the predisposition to home language is authentic in this program. And so when people talk about San Francisco, they think, well, success is a straight line, right? But this is what success really looks like in San Francisco. And I can attest to what it looks like as we try to affirm our commitment so that there's optimal development of children. And optimal development means that L1 is strong. We know already at kindergarten, our kindergartners are 1 year behind academically in their L1 language. And that's why there are probably people around this room who grew up in this country who have home language up to sixth grade or third grade capability, because there is no supports for the academic language. So some of the things we learned and what we did on a system level to support, you know, dual language, global literacy, workforce, linguistic diversity goals and policies. Well, we created this thing that said, okay, everybody's got to match, your staff have to match the linguistic ethnicity and diversity of your children. How many people do that in their states? That's the goal. And the policies is that we track them. But we found, because our workforce does match the linguistic diversity of our children, but we found that the linguistic diversity of the workforce doesn't ensure bilingual children. And that's because our workforce in L1 were not necessarily doing instruction. They were doing custodial. And their language is more on the custodial level in many of the preschools that were there. And there wasn't a strategic use of the language, even if you have the workforce. Strategic use of language is generally absent and undeniably important. And this is where we had associates with lead teachers speaking different languages, but the children never hearing academic home language, but hearing language in English. And so there's a value to the language. We invested in training requirements and opportunities. Now, this is the biggest laugh, and I see teachers in this room, that we required everyone to have 8 hours. If you teach in this city, you have to have 8 hours of dual language content knowledge. And it's documented. You go to a full-day seminar, you go to 2 4-days, whatever it is. And we found almost 100% of our teachers have gone through a dual language training. But that didn't do much. It was like putting our toe in the water, because you can go to a workshop, but applying what you know and changing how you speak to children and your patterns and changing the way you work takes much more time than that. We looked at that all teachers matter, that we had to make training accessible to all teachers in all their languages. And that's been a shift of resources if you really want to make dual language a reality. And that, you know, it's not only about strategies. You know about the class, and we did it in Chinese, and we all did the strategy of taught everyone how to do feedback loops and open-ended questions in Chinese and in the home language. Well, you keep asking those questions and the children don't answer. Well, it's because they don't understand what you're saying. There are certain questions you should ask in home language and certain questions you ask in English, depending on the abilities of the child. And so being able as a teacher to differentiate your learning strategies is a big leap that we have to do. We also invested in training for coaches. Every coach in this city has training in dual language. Because they have to go out and work in communities where there are dual language children. And that we have a challenge. Academically bilinguals are rare. And even at the teacher level, and at the coach level. Jerry is a rarity, and he is a rarity. And that the ERS in class are not made for DLLs. They're not, because they don't differentiate what's needed in the classroom for the home language to be supported, because they don't differentiate about culture and about how things are done in the classroom. The quality of the books. You need to have information books, you need fantasy books, you need all the different types of books if you're going to recognize and give value to the L1, whatever it is. The last thing we did is we need to focus on equity. We did a lot of work to try to get strategies and training to the teachers. We found that strategies alone didn't stick. And we found that we needed to raise the conversation at the leadership and to make this an equity issue for our children. So that there was something, the why behind it. Look, I'm just doing strategies. And I'm not knowing when to do it. But if you really want it to stick, you've got to know that this is why. Because if children lose their L1, they have a lesser chance of being ready and capable of English. And they lose their connection to their families, and it has huge repercussions on the family. So this is where we've made that commitment. Yeah. So as I think about the global reflection of L1 and L2 learning, I think if you look at Asian countries and the United States, we have common and uncommon goals. We both want our children to be biliterate and bilingual. But maybe not so biliterate in the United States. And there are social and political contexts and realities that impact our ability to do so and the challenge of doing so. So why don't you just look for a moment at China and the United States, and Yifang, you can chime in, and so can you, Jerry, and so can you, Sue, anyone around the room. if the goal is L1 and L2 oral language learning, how important is it in China that children have two languages?
For me to add, I think it's quite a given, because if you look at not just China, just probably in Asia, most of the countries in Asia have English as the foreign language required subject area starting from primary school.
And they're starting to do it in preschool. And Jerry, you say yes, right? And it's a real value. In the United States, is it a value? What do you think? Only if you're lucky. it is not as strong, but it is up there in some ways. We talk about DLL, right? We do that in our field. There is some acceptance now in the research, but it's not as strong with the expectation that you will end up, after you are educated, you will be bilingual and biliterate. It's not there. In literacy, in L1 and L2, in China, the expectation is there, absolutely, that they're going to write English. But in the United States, the expectation is not there. Very people know, actually in San Francisco, they need 80 words, characters, in kindergarten, if you're in a Mandarin immersion preschool.
So, just thinking from past history, when I was in school, you had to take a second language in order to matriculate into a two-year or four-year college, or I guess it was a month before your college, something like that. But it was so late in your education that you already solidified your own home language, English, and then you're basically just picking up this other language. It's elective, and a requirement, but it felt like it was just elective. There was no real requirement for taking it other than my college.
It made you a better human being.
Right, it made you more grounded or something like that. But most people who, you know, have their VAs or something and have to take that language requirement, they say, oh yeah, I took Spanish in high school or I took it in college, but they don't remember anything, you know, or speak at all. And I'm wondering if, as you know, a primary English speaker, when do you start immersing your child or requiring or expecting your child to start learning another language, and how do you choose which language?
It's a huge choice, but if you have money,
right?
What we are seeing
are
that our immersion programs, whether they be Spanish or English, are packed. We had a program open up just last year with a waiting list of 90 children for a tuition that was $2,200 a month for an immersion Chinese Mandarin program. There are those of us who value it, and it goes back to the value of L1 in this country and the value of L2 and how different it is in our socio-political realities, because in China, L1 is valued. It is the dominant language, but L2 is highly valued as well. It's an additive. Versus in this language, children know very early on, our teachers know very early on, our families know very, very, very early on the value of the home language compared to the value of English. In this country, the history has been, you know, there's a history, we have a graveyard of immigrant languages in this country, whether it's German or whether it's Japanese. Our country tends to make your home language, in order to belong, speaking English is almost a loyalty test. There's loyalty that is tied to it, because if you don't speak English, you're not considered American. It's a very big shift that impacts language learning for teachers and how they feel about their language and how important they want their children to learn English.
I'm also imagining that people from America that go and travel around the world, they feel other countries should speak English. I think it's more like believing you yourself. Versus all the other countries, they feel is very valuable. If you're in Europe, you speak with 3-4 languages, and you're literate in all 3-4 languages. But here in the United States, it's different. So it's more like our And I think it's more of our perception in terms of who we are here in the United States. So when we do come in, you know, and we're going to elementary school and we have, you know, your primary language, first language, eventually it disappears because it's like, wow, now you know English, therefore, you know what, you can be fine in this world, you see? Also, in the family, I think we need to educate our family to continue speaking the home language to the children. But at the same time, is to also emphasize that you need to speak that home language back. Now, from my personal experience, I immigrated to San Francisco, but now I live down in Newport Beach. But in my household, my parents did not understand any English at all. So I had no choice but to have to speak Chinese Mandarin to them in order to communicate with them. And it's the reason why children lose their language is because parents understand English. So therefore, a lot of the people I know, they could maybe understand, but they cannot communicate because they could communicate in English, but the parents understand. So therefore, they lose the speaking ability, but they may have the understanding of it.
So when you're from your own experience, you know that the value that the parents hold as new immigrants of language, L1 and L2, also impacts the dynamic of what we are seeing in our programs, that teachers are always saying, well, the parents want me to do this. And it's a very challenging situation that we have. How do we answer? How do we talk about it? You want to say something?
Yeah, in Georgia, we're having an issue right now with
Spanish.
Oh, I can speak louder. Here? Oh, no, I can speak louder.
Okay, great.
So we're having this issue with Spanish-speaking children. A lot of times the teachers or educators, 3 to 5, will tell their the parents to practice speaking English with the child at home. So what happens is 3 to 5 is that window of opportunity to develop language, and they don't have a strong language model at home. So if the parent is fluent in Chinese or Spanish, that's what they should be modeling, so that there is a strong language model so they can build their language foundation. And what we're seeing is a lot of these children are just losing that strong language foundation because they don't have a language model in either language.
And so we know that you can't build a strong L2 on a weak L1. And you know, this is your question in the back about, yes, does it make sense that we have our children lose their home language, the L1, and then have to learn some L3 to get out of college? And at what cost? And it comes back to our expectations and the value of both those languages equally.
You know, I think the jury is still out there at what point you introduce. There's many pieces, I believe, to this. You have the cultural piece, where you want the family to have their own language for the reason of being able to communicate. You have the economic reasons why people want to not learn Chinese, or why few years ago people were learning Japanese, and for a few years ago they were learning Middle Eastern Arabic languages. Because that's driven by the economic factors. Maybe not historic. So these modernistic people now want to learn more and more Mandarin. So there are many different reasons, I believe. There is also juries out there. I have read the papers or where they start the learning because there's a window of opportunity, there's no accent that they acquire. I've also read that it's better for them to first get their L1 solid, same that you're doing, so the terms were in. What Christian says is Jim Cummings has worked on, that it's easy to transfer first language to second language.
Absolutely. There's a lot of controversy, particularly in looking at dual language immersion for infants and toddlers.
But the point I'm making is that when you have a multilingual classroom, you have parents who are living here, who migrated here. There is a reason why they are here. So it's understandable they want their child to learn the language so they can succeed in the culture. So there is that dilemma. And who we as educators, what is our dilemma? What do? Do we tell them to support their child, or should it be the family's choice? What do they want to do?
I'm going to hold that, because Jerry has this question come to them, his staff, all the time. And as he talks, I want him to that a little bit more, and I can speak to it as well. And so again, and this very issue that we're talking about, this value in the social political context, you know that we only learned to speak Arabic during after the war when the government funded Arabic programs. We only learned to speak German after the war when the government, the Defense Department funded it. We learned to speak Chinese. There are a few Chinese programs because the Chinese government funded programs in this country. It's a very interesting, the context, the history of why our laws and systems are the way they are. But there are challenges for teachers when issues of power and language arise in the classroom. We often ask teachers, when there are two teachers, how strategic, what language do you discipline in? What language do you use positive descriptive acknowledgement? What language is used when you sing? What language and when? And who's using it, and who's wiping the tables, and who is doing this? Because language value matters for children, and they learn very quickly, and they cope. And so these issues of power and language arise also for the teachers themselves about how they feel about the language they speak, and also the institutional barriers that our field has for them to attain their credentialing that they need to remain in the field. So the next steps for San Francisco, we are making progress. I don't doubt that we aren't. Every single program that we have uses dual language strategies to some degree. But the intentionality, as we look, we are creating now a set of 10 intentional dual language immersion programs in our universal preschool program. It is a funding that we have set aside for this purpose because we're not doing enough. And so in these programs, we're using actually the SOI bilingual model, which will be adapted in for Cantonese, where we're actually identifying all the languages spoken in the classroom and identifying language goals for each language. We have three languages, four languages, so each language will have a goal. We establish language and literacy goals in, and we look at strategic use of the primary language that you choose. Perhaps you have two primary languages or one, but we're going to look through that day, and we're going to do dual language by time or by teacher. And that means, because these are the both methods work, children by time, you get 3 days in English, 2 days in Cantonese, or by teacher, where the teacher uses a definite language.
In your classroom,
what is the teacher set up in our classrooms? Generally, unless it's a family child care provider, there are generally more than one adult is in that classroom. And in depending on the makeup of the classrooms, because it's very diverse, they are getting to choose what is the model based on the workforce that you have that will work here. By primary caregiver approach, where the one caregiver speaks one language and stays that in that language through the whole day in instruction, or by time, where the children, maybe the teacher switch off, or you do half days and the other half days. To really make sure that instruction happens in early literacy and language in both.
Which, I don't know if either one is more successful for the children, less, maybe not confusing, but I mean, which one do you feel works better? Which one do children respond better to?
We've seen them work well both ways. It's harder for the teachers to do primary because it's easier to slip back into your whatever pattern you have. You have to be very disciplined. You have two schedules, one for the English language, one for the Spanish language, or whatever. And you know, is it my story time in English this week, or is it story time in Spanish this week? Is it story time? Okay, are we doing cooking in Chinese? Okay, who didn't come to the Chinese cooking class? Okay, and so this is where we're going to find out on how it works well. And we'll have 10 models to look at that. By next year, we'll be able to tell you. Nissan is going to be actually one of them that's going to be piloting it for us. But we're all doing this together. And we believe that that is going to be a really positive feature for our children and provide options for immigrant children.
Great. Thank you, Lisa, sharing your walk the talk to
walk
us.
Walk the talk.
I want to check how many of you came in later and didn't get a chance to see the GoFish video. Did y'all see it?
Yeah.
you. Okay. I guess that's your original plan.
Sure.
Okay, sure at the end?
Yeah.
Okay. You gotta see at the end. So now I'm gonna give the floor to Dr. Jerry Young. I'm gonna present to us on the climbing head start.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Okay. Probably the questions I'm going to ask are more than what I can offer you. I have a lot of questions. So I'm Jerry, and I'm working for Climbing Head Start in San Francisco, and we have three staff here. And we are a Head Start program. We provide three preschool services, including nutrition, health, everything for low-income families. So today I'm going to show you some numbers, kind of get you to get into the context about who we serve and what does the city look like. And also we have some program activities I want to share with you and also ask you questions. Next page, please. About the family. So here, next page, going to show you what does that look like in San Francisco. We talk about multicultural. We talk about bilingual. What does that mean? By the number, we can see later, by the number, in this city, there is about 33% Asian. Among those, 21.4% Chinese. His Latino family, down there, the number is 15%. And the way they calculate that is within the white. So white is about 1/3. So what does that mean? 1/3 white, 1/3 Asian, another Latino, and everybody. Do they live next door to each other, one by one, one by one? Probably not. So this is the nature of San Francisco. By number, very diverse. But when you go to each neighborhood, actually in Chinatown, you can stay there forever without speaking any English. You can get whatever you need. I don't speak Cantonese. Cantonese is a dialect in Chinese. I speak Mandarin. But when I go to Chinatown, people will talk to me in Cantonese. I always talk back in Chinese, in Mandarin, and they will talk back to me in Mandarin. So, but anyway, you don't have to have any English skills to survive in Chinatown. Same in Mission neighborhood. Similar situation. You can just use Spanish, have a happy life there. So that's the nature of San Francisco. Pretty interesting. Next one, please. Okay, so here, kind of, we're from Kaimi. Probably people asking, what does that mean? People asking me all the time. Kaimi in Chinese has an educational meaning. Kai means inspiration. Min means enlightenment. Altogether, it has some meaning in about early childhood education, according to traditional literature. We serve families. We are one of the PFA side. Lisa support. They have Lisa overseeing the county, the whole city, and we are one of those programs under the PFA. We got funding from the federal, also the state, and also from PFA. And here are families we serve. Majority of our families are Asians. Majority, almost everybody are Chinese. This year, the number is very high, 91%, 91.8. Sometimes it will run into 82, 85. But this year, 12, 13 is very, very high. 92% Chinese. Oh, sorry, 92% Asian. And at home, that's the language they use. We track this kind of number because we have to report to the Fed, the Office of Head Start in DC. So that's the primary language they use. You can see Chinese for those almost everyone those from those Asian families. They speak Chinese, and some of them, they have like it's a biracial marriage, so they have multiple languages. So the language will be primarily Chinese at home. Next one, please. low income. We serve low income families. So I mentioned you can live in Chinatown without saying, without any English. And in Chinatown, the living is not easy either. According to federal guideline, for the family of four, $23,000 is a low income guideline. What you can buy here in San Francisco, when you go online, you search your apartment. You search your apartment, what bedroom apartment for rent?
$3,000.
It ranges from $1,200 to $5,000. I haven't seen $5,000. Those luxury ones. I wish I can have one. And you have like a $1,200 one. However, something you could not find in Chinatown is $500. Why is that? Three-bedroom apartment. Three families rent one room of each. They share one bath, one kitchen, one living room. Now easily go $500 or $700. So living is not easy in San Francisco. And so that mixed up everything. We see there's a very, very interesting dynamic, the social dynamic in San Francisco. So based on that file was given, then that narrowed down to see about, from my viewpoint, what we see from our program about this issue, bilingual by literature. Oh, one more thing I really talk about. We talk about family. Then we talk about staff. Those are the people in the classroom working with young children. And let's look at where are they coming from. By number, Chinese, 86%. And we have Filipino teachers, Caucasian staff, teachers. And among those, the full time, we have like graduate degree, we have 11% with graduate degree. And we have majority there below AA. They are like a center A, floaters, they are part time, and also the classroom assistants. So looking at the Chinese, 86%, matching with those 92% Chinese kids. What's going to happen in there? Well, can you imagine what's going to happen? What language they will speak? They will speak a lot of Chinese. Yeah. So maintaining the L1, the first language in our program, well, it's not really a big issue. It's happening. Sometimes we even worry about, hey, you won't give children the equal exposure to both languages. And don't forget, speak some English. So in our program is quite interesting dynamic. Next one, please. Here, I want to highlight some teachers' belief survey. I'm afraid of blocking you, so it's okay. So we did a survey to our Chinese, only our Chinese teachers with 32 samples. We did a survey, it's like a two-page survey, but here I want to highlight six questions and answers. It's very interesting and very, very related to what we are talking about here about social and the cultural context. The teacher answered that they bring their home value to the teaching. Yep, almost everybody at certain degree. Even 50% answered strong and yes, for sure. What does that mean? No matter how hard you train your teacher, they will use their belief to teach. Is that true? Number two, they want children to maintain their cultural heritage. 94% almost everybody. I want my students to learn skills that lead them to succeed in the Caucasian culture, in American culture. Wow, yeah, still very high. We all have the same goal. Lisa mentioned to point out, globally, every culture has the same goal. They want their children to succeed. same here. However, I want to jump down to number five first. Number three and number five, put them side by side, you see, very interesting. They want children to be successful. However, number five say asking that school education is to foster academic excellences. Or in other words, people usually say school readiness. Yep, but it's not dominantly answered on that side, number five. You see that quite interesting. What's happening here? And back to number four, it's very Chinese. Since we have survey for Chinese teachers, children's moral development, very high percentage say yes. So here I want to show you some perspective that when we look at our program, when we look at this bilingual issue or even school readiness issue, we put it under the bigger umbrella of social or cultural context. The social context drives, or the cultural context drives how we design our program. And as I mentioned earlier, I have more questions to ask than what I can offer. We are building our dual language policy, you can say the policy or procedure, or procedural, or you can say our curriculum. We don't have that yet. There are a lot of Spanish English assessments, curriculum. However, in the United States, it's a stereotype. Chinese kids, oh, you're okay. I went to that college a few years ago. I went to looking for, I used the piano for my daughters. They are 10 girls, twin. So the piano shop, the guy asked me, are you Chinese? He said, oh yeah. Oh yeah, your children will continue to learn, so buy a good one. It's a stereotype. It's a real stereotype. Chinese kids, they will be okay. So that brings some issue about the resource. Usually, Chinese population don't get that much resource. So it's over the topic, that's one point this out. There's some kind of that stereotype in there. And number six, individualism, which is a very important part in very important element in American education. But our teacher, the answer to that question is right in the middle. It's a more like a normal distribution. People tend to enter two or three or two and four. What that tells us is we have a situation that the San Francisco culture, the social, the culture and our teachers, we don't have a definite answer what is the best yet. We are searching for that. We really don't know yet. We need more study, more research, more initiative to find out what is a better solution. About the curriculum. And let's move to the topic. We, as I mentioned, we put the bilingual or biliterate under the social context. And that's how we frame it in the agency. We are looking for a multiculturally competent pedagogy. The pedagogy, in short, in plain English, to learn skills that in order to be successful in the US and also maintain their home culture. We want both. Not only the language part, not only the literacy, but also the other area, like the values, the cultures, how they see people, those human qualities. You can see that the conflicts between two cultures, sometimes it's not about translation at all. Sometimes it's that I think differently than you. So when we consider this language thing, we putting on the bigger umbrella is about the culture. We have just started our journey. We don't have the curriculum yet. And we look at the social context. We do all kinds of things. Whatever training you can see, all the bilingual level and all kinds of using two languages, talking to children. Luckily, with the most classroom, we have more than Chinese kids. So teachers, they have to speak two languages. So all those kind of tricks or strategies, you can see we are doing that at different degree. Each classroom at different degree, at different level. But be very honest with you is we don't have a definite answer yet. What is the best model? We are searching for that. And let me give you one example. Can you ride a bicycle? Who cannot ride a bicycle? Raise their hand. Everybody can ride a bicycle, right? Who can ride the manual for the bicycle? Ride the manual. Who? You can ride the manual about bicycle.
Excellent. Ride manual about how to ride bike.
Okay. And who can fix your bicycle? And who can actually build a bicycle? Not many, huh? No one, huh? You can speak a language, doesn't mean you can teach. Right? I'm fluent in bilingual, doesn't mean I'm a good bilingual teacher. So we are exploring what is the best way of teaching. Yes?
Are you finding it difficult to acquire qualified teachers to be able to do, to teach at a level that you need them to teach at?
Thank you for the question. And I look a different way around. I look at what we have. And each one has different potential. Each teacher has different potential. Like our teacher, Nisana here, and Kama and Joseph, they all got the trainings. They all have big potentials. And this year we will start with Nisana's class because of the site. It's a very, very diverse site. We don't start from there. So the way I look at this issue is, oh, I believe all teachers have the talent of doing something. And we start from there to develop them, give them the resource to promote them.
So you do a lot of professional development with your teachers?
A lot. Yeah. We had another presentation this morning all talk about how we encourage teachers to initiate their ideas and how the administration support their ideas. Thank you. So back to what, yes?
Philosophy
of the
program. So my question is, what is the philosophy, and how do you see the teachers' belief
implementing philosophy? That's a tough question.
Could you repeat it?
Yes, I'm going to repeat it. The question. Okay.
The question
you
mean
mind,
yeah.
If you don't mind, can you ask
the
question?
My question is in regards to the program's philosophy. What is the philosophy, and how are the teachers who are mostly Asian influence, or how their beliefs influence the philosophy?
Another good question, that's dynamic. We just revised our philosophy recently. We have two philosophies. Educational philosophy, parent engagement philosophy. Okay, the philosophy should fit into our current group of people, this group of people. It's not something, oh, way above there, and that's worship that philosophy every year. No, we bring that philosophy to life. We have philosophy, educational philosophy, like 7 points. So how we develop that is we have a draft, and we bring to a staff, and we have staff talk about that, discuss about that, and we revise. So we come up with a philosophy together. Of course, we want to start with some draft, higher level draft, rather than just talking about experiences. Then that will back to another, to the issue about how we develop them. Yeah, sometimes it's impossible to have everybody buying everything in the philosophy. No, it's impossible. And you also need to recognize, when you talk to someone, like And my wife talked to me when I did, I went with my own perspective. I'm not going to follow exactly what she says. The same, when you talk to the teacher, the same. They will use their way to interpret. And in constructing with them, we call this accommodation, assimilation, isn't it? And children, like in a free play, they bring whatever way, whatever toy they have to play that in their own way. This can be a form. This can be a spoon. They adopt, they assimilate this thing into their way. Staff assimilate that philosophy into their way. But that is a process. That's excellent opportunity for professional development process. You rather have staff who want to ask, to challenge, rather than just listen. If they just listen, they will just forget. So, we are searching for that twice the best. And we are doing a couple things I want to share here with you. The most important thing is we are working with Lisa to have our bilingual site, demo site with PFA. We want to take it seriously starting this year. And Lisanna will be the lead teacher there, site manager over there. We want to develop a program model. However, as I mentioned, we don't know what to do yet. We will use the SOE bilingual as a starting point, but we have to develop our own. The SOE bilingual is Spanish English based, but we are Chinese English based, so we need to develop our own. There is no way to just translate. It's not going to be valid at all. And also we are working on another thing is, we have been working with University of Colorado to develop a Chinese English language screening tool. That is not available anywhere in the US. There are a lot of Spanish English assessment tool, but nothing available in Chinese. Years and years and years people keep saying, We have been working with a researcher from University of Colorado. Her name is Dr. Pui-Fang Kang. We work on this project for 3 years already. We are developing a tool that will be available. But why do we want to develop that? I want to give you some example. How much more time? This is a DRDP major. The DRDP is a required assessment tool in California. And they have different sections, health, nutrition, blah, blah, blah. Here's the language part. Here's the language section. Look at this. Yeah, it's true. I mean, nothing here is wrong. But when you put this major to a new immigrant kid, how do you measure that? Next page. They have another small section for patients, about for ELL kids, ELD kids. Again, that's looking at how is the English doing. It's not about how is the home language. California is interesting. I forgot what year, 1970 something. California was the first state in the United States who the Supreme Court decided that, the final decision was that the state has to provide bilingual education. But 10 years ago, California also is the first state to approve an initiative, English only. So the kind of dynamic going on here, we want children to learn English. We want them to be successful. We want them to, even though they work for McDonald's, they can read the word hamburger. We don't need to print a hamburger there to make sure they press the right button. We are, that's understandable. But then it's more than that. When we look at high level choice development, it's high, there's something higher than that we should focus on. It's not just like learning the English. How about children, the new immigrants, their social, emotional, their everything? It's not measured. So we have been working with Dr. Pei-Fang Kang to develop the tool to really measure children, Chinese, English speaking children using both languages to understand where they are. And that's a third year. Hopefully we can have this tool to measure our kids. Now, I'm going to do a small exercise to help you better understand why that's important. I'm going to show you five pages. And I'm going to ask a question in Chinese. Pretend you're 4 years old. You just moved to Taiwan with your parents 3 months ago. You are now going to do a language screening test. You're going to take that test. And I will decide whether you need a whether you need an IEP. Okay, starting from 5 pages, I'm going to speak in Chinese. Just like a new immigrant kid, everything they heard, whatever is English, and that you experience that. 这是什么?
Yeah.
不错哦! who knows? Who can answer this? 鸭子. 王室的鸭子。 这是什么?
面包。 4块面包。
面包。
4片面包。
这是什么?
这是筷子。
Kinds. It's very obvious. Some kids are going to IEP. This is what? This is the Chinese bun. Yeah, it's one of those major food in northern China. It's a basic social oriented, right? It's not common. 哪一只是马? Okay, give you a hint. Which one is a horse? Finally, that one is right. That's how children they experience here. In San Francisco, the Unified School District, according to them, 80% of Chinese kids who was classified as IEP, they were reclassified as a typical by fourth grade. And many of those IEP, they are language delay. So here's the problem. Language delay is a serious issue. But how about, it's not really a delay, it's just about they are new learning. The problem is no tool. No tool to measure that. Then, for us, as a program operator, we don't have a specific tool, curriculum, to help them to maintain both. Back to my question, my example, we can all ride a bike, but not everyone can teach people to ride a bike. We can speak bilingual, but doesn't mean we know how to teach.
These are the DRDP section with the language.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't they say that if you cannot assess the child and if you know, use the language, that they can actually solicit the family or other people to help be able to provide that assessment?
DRDP is more classroom teacher observations.
Right.
Yeah, and there's another tool that's more parents' feedback, parents' input. But the DRDP is very primarily what happened in the classroom from teacher's perspective.
What you're talking to me. Because
yeah.
I was just thinking in terms of assessing children, you know, when teachers have to appreciate the DRDP, there's that section for dual language learners, right? The language
mm-hmm.
learners, and they did specify that you can actually solicit like parents or even teachers or people who actually speak that language to help with the assessment.
Probably I'm giving the wrong answer. I need to have our teacher to answer that for me.
Right. I mean, I don't know.
Yeah,
I'm saying that the
yeah.
perception of the fact that the IEP, because they don't speak English,
mm-hmm.
does they assume that, you know, they're having language problems,
yeah.
in actuality, just
yeah.
they just don't know English.
Yeah.
So that's the confusion.
Mm-hmm.
But I think if you do do the negotiation of him or them,
mm-hmm.
then it should be okay that they don't fall into that trap of thinking that they have to get teach language therapy or anything like
yeah.
that. Right?
Here's a very tricky part. The all those language parts. So okay, we want all the assessment tools need to be reliable. So you must follow certain criteria. But I see that happening. What's happening is sometimes teacher they need to be smart to make some adjustment to get the right scoring. Yeah. However, when you make that adjustment, it's not reliable already.
Mm-hmm.
So all back to the same issue, this is not a appropriate tool for teachers to assess bilingual kids.
It's also the, and I think Jerry's talked about this with me before, the challenge of comparing sequential bilinguals in the same developmental framework as monolinguals. Because we know that, for example, if you do a vocabulary test, a vocabulary assessment, well, if you're testing English, they'll have so many words, and the English learner will have less. But if you take into account the vocabulary they have in both languages, they tend to have equal amounts. So when you're looking at those the assessments, they may not provide an accurate picture of a child who has a delay because they actually have more words. It's not that they aren't learning languages, but we're only counting half that they know. And that their sequential bilinguals have their own developmental path and their own norms. So when we compare children, it causes us to have a false assumption that they are delayed or something.
But isn't it true, like, if the teachers feel like you have a language delay, not speech, but not speech, but just language, and you actually send them, this isn't preschool, you actually send them to your local school district, right, your local school, when you do the assessment, and they know Chinese is your primary language, once they assess you in that language, they don't assess you in English if English is not your primary language. So then they have an idea that you're having trouble with your primary language first, because then it will affect your second language, which is English. Like, don't get assessed in your primary language, whatever that language is, if they think that you may have a language.
And if they're assessing in one language,
right.
it's the monolingual Chinese, and it doesn't take into account the combined learning of the languages. So it's still, we're still comparing apples to oranges, even if in the system. And so it does set up a false high number of children that are referred in the Asian languages for speech
so
and language.
They learn it at the same time, not like, if they get into English and Chinese like from infancy, then they'll have this little struggle between the two, right? Because it's not like you only have one language at home and they introduce second language at school. So you're saying that they get simultaneously they're learning both languages, therefore they fall a little short. So then you think that there's a language delay and you get sent to get an IEP.
No, is it that the screening and the diagnostic protocols don't allow for channel switching essentially to then be able to really get at the comprehensive ability of the child? Because the protocol requires one language or the other language, but not the ability to move between as the child might need.
Looking at sequential bilingual language development and the norms for that, versus you have Chinese language development with a sequential bilingual, you can't compare it to the monolingual Chinese speaker either.
So let me very quick complete this session. So as I mentioned, we are doing on the assessment tool. And just one thing I just talked about is we are working with Asian Art Museum to develop an aesthetic curriculum.
Mm-hmm.
And that will connect to the Chinese. Because Chinese character, each word, each character itself is art. And we are just trying to combine both. Two directions, they will have some, two directions with some connections in some way. To conclude this part, I know I'm running out of time, but a little bit entertainment. I want to play a 2 minute video. It's our program introduction about parent engagement. and you can see five parents they were interviewed in that video. But surprisingly, we didn't tell them what to say. They did practice, but they decided what to say. Four out of five mentioned about they appreciate children learn language. What they say language is English. So you can see this. Meanwhile, we want children to maintain L1, but parents, they also want children to learn L2.
In many different ways, but the most important is like how to parent my daughter better and be able to understand her behaviors. And the more you are basically, you know, connected to your child, the better you have a better relationship with them. With Taiming, I feel very confident and I think I'm doing a great job so far.
Estoy muy agradecido con Jaime, con el programa, porque nos ha ayudado mucho, especialmente a mi familia, a mis hijos con el idioma. Y ahora veo mucho progreso y mi hijo ahora está hablando los dos idiomas. No perfecto, pero le ha ayudado mucho. Estoy muy agradecido por eso.
祝福请您谢谢提供给我们的图书现在的身体就喜欢非常喜欢念书听课的书
And I'm really glad that I found timing and they helped me a lot with my children's education, with the English studies, and they helped me to learn how to do the cooking.
So
I recommend for everyone to go
training. So quite interesting, many parents or grandparents they mentioned about language, right, in that testimony. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Jerry. I had a privilege to visit one of his sites in Chinatown and interviewed a parent who had both children going through preschool and transitioning to a elementary school down a few blocks. So it was an amazing experience to have that interface with the program and of course benefiting from Lisa's preschool's investment into the program. So the next panel of experts that we're having is Dr. Yifang Li. She is the co-founder and a core member of the Global Childhood Collective. It is a project that aims to explore and understand the experiences of childhood in Asia. And the participating Asian cultural locations are Hong Kong, Japan, Korea, Malaysia, Taiwan, and Thailand. And I am going to give the cyberspace to Yifang. Yifang, can you hear us okay? She's currently in Australia. I think it's about 8 o'clock in the morning. Okay. Let me know when you want me to go to the next slide. Oh, can you see where I am?
Okay.
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 So if you have any questions, you will have to come up to the mic so Yifang can hear you.
Okay. Okay, actually, you can point me to the audience so I can see some hands or some reflections.
Is that good?
And I can just tell, yes, thank you. And then I can just tell you, please do the next slide. Is that okay?
Yes, perfect.
Okay. So, hi, good morning, everyone from Australia. It's about 8:33 in the morning. So it's been a pleasure to hearing the different talks by Lisa and Jerry. So what now I'm going to do is to offer a different perspective, or maybe from a global perspective, of how the notion of language and literacy education is actually happening now in parts of Asia. So let's go to the next slide, which is a really interesting lead table that I would say bring a lot of heated debates nowadays, particularly when it comes to education in the just globally speaking, comparatively how different countries are doing in terms of how well they are doing, particularly in this slide that I'm only highlighting this notion of literacy. So what was striking back in 2009 was that when China, particularly Shanghai, participated in PISA, they sort of become the star participants in this high-stake testing, pen and paper-based type of assessment. So what was amazed by many different people and from across different nations was that Shanghai, China, particularly, they score very high in all the scores. And one important thing that I would need to point out is that these tests were done in L1, so mostly first language. So building on that, I also want to mention that in just about every nation in Asia, all of the countries do have English as their second language education, as one of the core subject area in national curricular programs. So it's quite interesting how, like Lisa was mentioning, how differently politically or globally, how people are positioning the notion of language education or maybe becoming literate in multiple languages is being accepted differently. So let's go to the next slide. I only want to briefly point out what PISA tells us, and also highlight this notion of what PISA does not and cannot tell us. Believe it or not, many different policymakers are actually looking into PISA as one strong indicator of how it tells us about the notion of achievement and how good the education system currently is. So it actually tells about how students are performing in the assessment domain, primarily literacy, mathematics, and science. And it also the core of PISA is the 15-year-old students. And for us in early childhood education, we might say, well, 15 years old, they're in senior high school, or they're in junior high school, they are teenagers. They are a bit far ahead from what we have in our classroom, mostly the 3 to 5 year old children. But actually, I think, and our group argue that for high-stake testing like this, PISA, it would actually have a trickle-down effect to early child education. So, for example, if we are placing certain emphasis on literacy, it would eventually have a trickle-down effect to early child education, and that would change the way we prepare our students for them to our children for them to go on to kindergarten, for them to go on to primary or elementary school, and so it actually has a trickle-down effect. So I think it's important for us to focus on this notion of what PISA does not and cannot tell us. It gives us numbers, it puts countries in a league table, but it actually cannot tell us how different countries are viewing, for example, literacy differently, and how different countries are imagining or maybe conceptualizing pedagogical practice differently in classroom situation. So let me give you a little bit of input to the next slide. Let me give you a little bit of the project background for our Global Childhood Project. We are actually looking into the experiences of childhood across six different places in Asia. Like Lisa had just mentioned, it includes Thailand, Malaysia, Korea, Japan, Taiwan, and Hong Kong. And for the point of, from my point of view, I'm going to present you some stories from Hong Kong. And our initial focus is on literacy, the notion of how literacy is being conceptualized in Hong Kong. And it's not a monolingual society. The spoken language is Cantonese, but then the print is actually mainstream Chinese, so the traditional Chinese. And nowadays, Hong Kong and Taiwan are the only two places that still use traditional Chinese. Other places have already converted or switched to simplified Chinese, like mainland China, Malaysia, if the Chinese population in Malaysia, or maybe the Chinese population in Singapore or in Indonesia and many places else. The print system they use is a simplified Chinese system. So our approach to understand the notion of childhood is coming from an ethnography approach that is trying to sit in the classroom, trying to observe what is actually happening, and trying to interpret the ways in which children or teachers are having new definitions about literacy and language learning. So next slide, I'll show you some, just only some of the highlighted research questions that we try to do across multiple different locations with our partners. For example, how is literacy located in school curriculum? So perhaps we look into how many credit hours in the curriculum is actually focused on literacy. And when we talk about literacy, it's not just about our L1, it might be L2 as well. So maybe in what ways is literacy taught and practiced in local schools? For example, later on I'll show you how maybe English is being taught, and how Mandarin Chinese or Putonghua is being taught, and how L1, Cantonese, is being used in daily practice in the classroom. So we also try to understand how do parents and teachers regard as their role in children's becoming literate. And it's quite interesting that when our research partners come together from multiple different locations in Asia to meet for the first time in Hong Kong, it was back in 2009, we tried to come up and define the notion of literacy or becoming literate. We quickly realized that there is a cultural definition and cultural dimension about becoming literate. So for example, becoming literate in English is narrowly being defined as being able to read and write. However, when it comes to, say, a Chinese definition of becoming literate, it might be more than that, particularly from our partners coming from Thailand. They define becoming literate as the notion of becoming civilized, becoming educated. So actually literacy, or this notion, simply notion of becoming literate, is actually broader than we would imagine. So it has a cultural dimension. So maybe we can go to the next slide to talk about some of the cultural observations and notes about literacy and the ways in which early childhood education is presented in Hong Kong. So to begin with, I think it's quite important to point out that early child education, known as kindergarten, in Hong Kong is for children between 3 to 6 years old, so just before primary education. So it has a very different meaning when it compares to kindergarten in a United States type of understanding. Kindergarten is 5 years old for in the United States, but then for Hong Kong, kindergarten is much more like preschool plus kindergarten in the US. And it's quite different that the way in which early childhood education is structured. For example, some of the highlights would be you will see multiple teachers of different subject areas. So very much like primary school in early child education classrooms in Hong Kong, you will see they oftentimes have time for English teacher to come in to work with children for 30 minutes, say 30 minutes, three times a week, or even four times a week, or on a daily basis, that a native English teacher will come into the classroom to work with young children about English. And then there will be a native mentoring, or in the context of Hong Kong, there was a Putonghua teacher to come into the classroom to work with young children on Putonghua. And then you will be able to see, if you go to, say, a typical Hong Kong preschool, you will see a strict timetable. And then you would also see children working with textbooks and teachers working with textbooks. So all of the curriculum is packaged in units by textbooks. And then you will see children as young as 4-year-old, 3-year-old, and the 5-year-olds will go home with worksheets or a workbook or homework. So by this time, I would imagine a typical question from the West would say, well, what about play? Do they play at all at school? And what is play, and how is play being interpreted in Asian culture, or in this case, in Hong Kong? One thing that I would add to that would be there is actually a cultural dimension and interpretation about play. So play is actually there, but it's not about discovery play. It's not about free play. It's not not much about dramatic play. It's very much about structured play. So you might be able to see children playing for maybe 10 minutes, and it's very structured to work with the manipulatives. That's a notion of play. So let's go to the next slide. You will be able to have a quick feeling about a typical day, because it's a timetable, and it's actually, for example, when I do classroom observation, I can just look at the timetable, and then really, it's on schedule. You will be able to find where the children are, what the teachers are doing, and it's very much so on a daily basis. Maybe there will be some dramas or there will be some accidents, but then, believe it or not, it's very structured. And most of the programs in Hong Kong is half-day program. Starts at about around 9 o'clock, so children can come. Say by 8:30 in the morning, the school door will be the kindergarten store will be opened, and then roughly around 9 o'clock, it will start beginning with the morning exercise, some of the singing and greeting songs and body movements, and then also singing the Chinese national anthem, and then quickly by 9:15, the teachers will gather the children for group instruction for homework. So that would be the time, a group instruction about the homework for the day. And then moving on, you see the toilet time. They all go to the toilet at the same time. So you will be able to see how children are being expected to become students. So the childhood switch to studenthood by then, that your body is regulated, you follow the timetable, rather than being about you. It's about the group moving on together. And then from 10 to 10:30, it's the notion of systematic teaching according to a commercial textbook. That's the notion of textbooks and how units of studies are being organized into different different categories and how teachers are incorporating that. And particularly for the school that I observe, they do have English teacher coming in from starting from Thursday and Fridays. So it's actually 3 days a week. And when the English teacher comes in, it will become English time. And then you see, I'm not going to go through that, but then this timetable somewhat gives you an idea of what a typical day would look like for a typical five-year-old in Hong Kong. I would say that over my six years in Hong Kong, I've observed more than, for student teaching observation, observed more than about 300 in-service teachers in multiple different schools. And I would say this type of timetable is actually very common. Most of the schools would have something similar to this. Maybe the ways in which they structure would be very different, that would be somewhat different, but not very much. So it's pretty much, you see, the learning is being structured in chunks of time. And the most, I would say, the longest period is about 30 minutes of a block. And I don't know how you think about that, but for me, I think it's really moving too fast and too rapid and too often for too many children at young age. So you constantly see children being asked, saying, hurry up, tidy up, let's get ready for the English teacher, let's get ready, bring out your workbook, let's do this, let's do that. So it's a lot of structures and directions by the teachers. And when you interview the teachers, they said, well, we don't like it, but then we really need to focus on the time that we have with young children. It's only about 3 hours a day. So next slide, I think that I will do a little quick introduction about how literacy is being defined in Hong Kong. So it's very formal. It's about reading, encoding, and then writing, decoding, and has a very strong emphasis on this notion of biliteracy and trilingual. So it's actually a language policy in Hong Kong, the notion of biliteracy and trilingual. So, 两文三语, meaning Chinese and English biliteracy, being able to read and write in Chinese and English, and then being able to speak and understand or converse in Cantonese, Putonghua, meaning Mandarin Chinese, and also English. So for young children, as young as 3 years old, they are trying to introduce children and trying to help children to understand the links between oral language and written language. Like I said, Cantonese is a, well, Jerry talked about that Cantonese is a dialect, and it doesn't really have a writing system. But then in Hong Kong, if you write in the oral language, you, for people that are not from Hong Kong, you will really have to be able to speak Cantonese to understand that. So there is actually a distinction between the print and the oral language. So at the current stage, through my observations and through our team observations, we believe and also conclude that at this moment, become literate in Hong Kong is mostly through trilingual practice, and it starts very at a very young age. So the notion here, the question here, I think the key question here is medium of instruction. What language do we teach children? And what language do we use to teach young children? And if you do a memory flashback to the timetable, can we go back to one slide? To look at the timetable. If you look at this timetable, you will be able to see a lot of the notion of code switching. So children are actually being required to switch from one language to the other language. When they are with their Cantonese teachers, they speak in Cantonese. When their English teacher comes in, it's all English, no Cantonese, no Mandarin Chinese. When the Mandarin Chinese comes, when the Mandarin Chinese teacher comes in, they speak Mandarin only. So we see a lot of code switching throughout the 3 hours of the school day. Okay, I guess we can go to the next slide.
What is the title of the slide, Yifang? How is Chinese
yes,
taught?
How is Chinese taught?
Got it.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, we are.
So how is Chinese taught and learned? When people talk about Chinese in Hong Kong, most of the time they talk about oral language, Cantonese versus. Okay, I only have how many minutes? 8 minutes? Okay, thank you. So when we talk about language in Hong Kong, it's about oral language and written language. So the constant need to create connections for young children. That one thing you say does not necessarily be the other thing that you write on the paper. So for example, how should I put that? Sofa. Sofa in Cantonese would be equivalent of sofa. But then when you write that in Chinese, you would have to write a different way. So it's very interesting that the way that there's a gap between the oral language and the written language. Therefore, for children to be able to make the connection, it's quite important for them to be able to become capable of formal reading and formal writing. So Cantonese is just a dialect, but then when they write, it's all about Mandarin Chinese, and it's all about the correct grammar and the correct ways in which you would be able to read. So it comes to meaning making, and it comes to the notion of copying forms. So especially Chinese is not an alphabetic system of language. So it's quite important for children to get the strokes right and get the sequence right. And therefore there's this big debate of which language should we teach children and which language should teachers use in China, in Hong Kong after the political handover in 1997. So some might argue that, oh, let's just try to teach in Zhonghua. Whereas some would say, well, the Cantonese is really our first language, so we still teach in first language, but then engage children with more understanding in Zhonghua. So it's very interesting how people are viewing language from a political perspective. And then let's move on to the next one. How is English being taught and learned? Again, at the early childhood stage, it's mostly about listening and speaking, but it also entails some parts of memorizing words and trying to use it within a sentence, so meaning making. And then mostly it's being taught through a phonetic system, so sort of like orthophonics. Using the language for communication and meaning making starts with orthophonics. So it's quite interesting that how the native English speakers are actually being brought to Hong Kong, but then using a commercialized textbook to teach English. So let's go to the next slide. I'll give you a brief, a quick vignette about the morning routines for the 5-year-old children in Hong Kong. On the whiteboard in the morning, in any typical morning that when I walked into the classroom, I'll see a whiteboard and that listed out the homework for the day. And you will be able to see it's bilingual because it talks about Chinese becoming literate in Chinese. So the children would have to copy down a sentence in Chinese. This one will be Hong Kong has a lot of houses. And then in English, it will be trying to understand a sentence. It is a frog. So what do you see here? There's no connection between Chinese and English. It's two parallel subject areas for young children. And then you will be able to also see there is an early mathematics type of exercise, a combination of 1 to 15 practice addition, and then a combination of 1 to 10 practice subtraction. So it's very, very academic oriented. I would say it's very much like first grade in US or even second grade in US. So next slide, you will be able to see some of the classroom pictures, some of the photos that I have taken. One particular thing that I will point out is, I think it's on our right hand side, you see this little piece of white paper. It actually shows how children, it teaches how most classrooms would have lots of worksheets like this on board in the classroom for young children to take, and therefore they can try to teach themselves to write certain words, certain Chinese characters in the correct way. And then next slide, you will be able to see some photos of the children's homework. This is their homework. So they take home books, worksheets and books, and these are what they need to be writing in Chinese. And the next one, this is where the image literacy, the Western influence comes in, where the teacher is trying to incorporate storybooks and trying to make connection of reading and writing as meaning making for young children. And let's see, I don't know if you can see that clearly or not, but at some point of the pictures, there are even some English writings. So you will be able to see how young children are becoming biliterate in two languages. And then the next one, my question will be children at work or children learning. So you see these children are writing homeworks, writing in square boxes, writing neatly as they are required to. So our next slide. So when we try to make sense of what's actually happening in Hong Kong, and this notion of becoming multiliterate, and this notion of multiliteracy and multilanguage in children's life words, we see a lot of ambiguities, that we see there are paradoxes that's actually happening, and that makes it very complex to understand. For example, we see a binary construction of formal and informal literacies and languages being used in classroom. So the teacher may be using a particular way of helping young, say their oral language in Cantonese is helping young children to be able to become, to be able to read and write formally. So you see this formal and informal switching back and forth constantly. And also you see this political and cultural status of biliteracy and trilingualism. So one quick example would be some of the native English speakers that go into Hong Kong to teach English, their salary will be higher than the kindergarten teachers in Hong Kong. So there's actually a status difference between languages, and the notion of the economies of children's life words. So we see a very strong distinction between school versus home. Whereas, for example, if you look at the timetable of the school day, you will be able to see it's actually becoming students. So it's an emphasis on studenthood rather than maybe an emphasis on childhood. And therefore, education for young children is very academic-driven. The notion of becoming literate is narrowing down to being able to read and write rather than maybe meaning-making. So there is a strong focus on how do we use language as an academic tool. And I think I have a short clip that I can...
Yes, I'm going to play it right now. It's a quick show. You might not be able to see it. I'm going to have to close this one down.
Okay.
We're almost there. There's a short clip of it. It's right here. Oh, it's right here. It's right here. I need to make it smaller. There we go. Okay. That was the clip.
Yes, it was very short. And the meaning of this movie that clip was just maybe give you some visual clue about the classroom. And also, it's a shortcut of teaching young children to become able to write in Chinese in a very particular way that that particular teacher is using a similar pedagogy of teaching. So I think to end my presentation, I would end it with one news that I read over the weekend that I don't know if you have heard about this news or not, but apparently it's creating a big controversial debate on the cyberspace from England. That there was a girl, I think 17-year-old girl, who was going to interview for a part-time job at the Body Shop in Cambridge. And one of the requirements from the manager of that store, of that branch, was that she would have to be able to speak Mandarin Chinese to get the job in Cambridge, United Kingdom, in UK. And it somewhat started up a big controversial and also made it to the news that the father of that 17-year-old girl is finding it absolutely ridiculous that how a store like Body Shop can require their employee can use that as a criteria to reject a job for any prospect employees. And of course it goes on and on, and essentially by the end the manager or the the headquarters of Body Shop came out and apologized that they don't intend to discriminate any people regardless of age, sex, and nationality, and also they look for the right person based on skills. What interests me is this discussion about why Chinese, and also links back to Lisa's notion of I remember Lisa mentioning that there are two Mandarin Chinese immersion school, and believe it or not, it's primarily for middle and upper class children and middle and upper class families. So I think it's important for us to think about language and literacy education from a global perspective, rather than from a limited local perspective, and how that essentially becomes something else beyond the four walls of the classroom.
Thank you, Yifang. Thank you so much for your presentation. And the project website is globalchildhoods.net, and you can find Yifang from there. And I see all of you are still here. Thank you. And hopefully all of the presenters today have provoked you to go back home to think about what you've been doing, what you have been seeing in your own communities, and what can you do differently within your community. And if you want to share some of your feedback from this session, please go to the NYC AIF member forum. Just log on with your same ID, membership ID, and just type them in. And then We're very open. We are accepting new advisors or members joining the AIF so we can promote this work further because this is critical. Lisa, Jerry, Yifan, do you have anything else to add to this?
I think after hearing Yifan, talk, I think it's looking at what are our assumptions about emergent literacy as they impact our Asian countries abroad and how we're discovering they are going to unfold here in this country as we develop our biliterate, bilingual children. That immersion program that I talked about, that's $2,200 a month, it's Reggio Mandarin Immersion. And their children are biliterate. By the end of the preschool year, they have 120 characters and are reading in Chinese and in English. And so it is very possible, but it involves so much more than what we've attempted to do thus far. We can say, if it's good enough for that child, why not this child? And it's a question for ourselves.
So thank you very much for your time again. Thank you, Yifan. Thank you, Lisa. Thank you, Jerry. Thank you, everybody.